Check out suncommon.com.
Ruben and his team from RB Technologies on Route 14 in East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Marsha Curtis from Capital Steel.
He's our IT specialist. We go to him for everything that we need for the computer systems, our security systems, our perception monitoring. If we've got a question about our email, a computer, Windows, any kind of situation that we run into, we run to Ruben. Oh, his customer service is great, along with being extremely professional. They're very personable. It's not like somebody sitting in here and talking a bunch of computer speak to you. They actually listen. They answer your questions in English, which is really good. And they don't look at you like you're absolutely crazy, you know, when you say, my computer is making this really strange picture or whatever it's doing. And they always seem to come up with a solution. It's really great. It works really well for us.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little chilly out there. My goodness, temperatures dropped already pretty close to 10 degrees since about 6 this morning. And it is going to get a lot colder. Forecaster Roger Hill says we got a deep freeze on the way. Warming back up on Friday. Thanks for joining us on the program. Want to thank Ken Squire for sitting in for me last week. Had a nice adventure down to our nation's capital. If we get time, maybe we'll have an opportunity to chat about that. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin hour number two. Not sure I'm going to mention that I was down there because they'll say, well, why didn't you stop in? Which seemed to be kind of a reoccurring theme last week. In any case, we'll be chatting with them. Big week at the Vermont Legislature. I'll be broadcasting there on Wednesday, Thursday, and as we have traditionally on Friday. So we'll be down there 3 days this week. The governor joins us on Fridays. He's been kind enough to agree to do that again this year. He'll join us coming up at about 10:10 on Fridays. On Wednesday, we'll chat with the Speaker of the House. Shap Smith will join us to kick off the program. Tomorrow, we'll be joined by a couple of political reporters. We're going to be talking with John Walters, who writes and blogs for the Vermont Political Observer, and Ann Galloway, who is the editor at vtdigger.com. Later today in the program at 10:15, we'll be joined by our political analyst extraordinaire, Eric Davis, will join us. We'll get a preview of the legislative session, which obviously will open up later on this week. Love to take your phone calls throughout the program as well. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Want to also later, if we have time, share with you a really moving speech by Stuart Scott, the ESPN broadcaster who died yesterday at the age of 49. Oof, every day is a gift. All right, we get right down to business here this morning. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning. I like really bringing interesting people to the program, and I think we're going to be in for a treat this morning. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Ned Hayes. Ned is a novelist who has written Sinful Folk. He writes about the Middle Ages, and we'll bring it all back home here to the present times, too. Ned, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
So what was your interest in the Middle Ages?
Well, I studied medieval lit in grad school in the 90s, and studied with some eminent medieval scholars, and found myself really intrigued by the stories of average people, because often you read stories about noble people, kings and queens, but the life of average people was really, really fascinating.
What was it about that? Why would you be so interested in something that's average?
Well, it seems to me like all too often we ignore what people actually had to go through day to day to make a living, to put food on the table, to raise their kids. And I found myself wanting to write stories about people who had to make ends meet in the midst of, you know, knights and armies all around them. How did these people actually get from point A to point B when they were basically owned by feudal lords. I found it really interesting to find out how the church was over everybody, and yet half the people in the world didn't seem to really believe what the church was saying. They just kind of went along with it.
Huh.
That might be kind of similar to today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you are a student of theology as well, too.
Yes, I've studied theology. I went to seminary for a few years. There's stories all over the map as far as you look.
So you went to seminary for a few years. How come you didn't follow through and enter the priesthood?
Well, like I said, I found that the church had a great story, and I found it really, really interesting. But I ended up, at the end of the day, finding myself kind of agnostic about how much God actually influences us day to day. I really believe that there are great human endeavors happening, but I'm not sure that I see the hand of God in everything. And some of my colleagues in seminary did see that, so I found myself unable to pursue the priesthood.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned living in that era of time, a pretty tough time to live. Can you describe how bad and how terrible and how difficult it was?
Absolutely. If I had many hours, I could go on, but very, very briefly, most people during the winter starved because they didn't have refrigerators, and food could not be stored over long periods, which is why we've ended up with things like lutefisk and pickles and things that would last over the winter. People invented these things in order to have food that would remain in the middle of January. So most people during the winter starved. And most people who were peasants also could not travel more than about 20 miles from the place they were born. So the story that I told actually took a group of peasants hundreds of miles across England, which at that time period was like going to the moon.
Mm-hmm. And this is a historical novel, as it's called, and it is actually based on a real event. And the time period we're talking here is roughly 1377. So what was the event?
Well, the event, according to the historical records, is that a group of peasants took the bodies of their dead children who were killed in a house fire across England to the king to demand justice. And that's all that we know from the historical record. A very strange occurrence. Like I said, it was like going to the moon. And so if they took their dead children across England, why would they do that? And so I invented a backstory to explain why they would do that and to explain the perspective of one woman who traveled in disguise with them.
Mm-hmm. So what was your theory on why they were demanding justice?
Well, at that time, there was a lot of suspicion about outsider groups, including groups that didn't even exist anymore. So in 1325, the Jews, for example, were expelled from England. But in 1377, there were supposedly sightings of Jews in England doing terrible things. And other minority groups were accused of other things. But the Jews happened to be kind of this ghost figment that people would point at. And so my theory was that there was some of that prejudice happening. And also, my theory was that people actually fled the village because they killed the children and they were escaping from possible justice. And so my main character follows them, goes with them, and discovers who actually did the murder.
Mm-hmm. Ned Hayes is the author of Sinful Folk. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Can you describe Mir?
Sure. She's a woman who is very, very resourceful. She speaks several languages. And for 10 years, she's lived as a mute in a village disguised as a man. And there are actually historical records of many women doing this, surprisingly. She lived totally behind the scenes. No one knew she was female. No one knew all of her capabilities. And in this story, all of her triumphs and her possibilities come to the forefront.
Wow. Okay. Why were there a lot of women at this time living as men, or was it as men or as mutes, or both?
Men. Because women were not allowed to own property. Women were not allowed to have any say in the legal process. And most women, except for noble women, had no rights in the world at large. And so being able to disguise yourself as a man or even being able to say legally that you were male, even if everybody knew you were female, gave you a lot of rights and privileges.
Mm-hmm. How did these people do this 200-mile journey?
Well, in my story, I actually have them take an ox cart and hook a couple of horses to the front of the cart and pull it across England. And the historical record doesn't actually say how they did it. It does say that they took the bodies of their children, which I find really macabre and terrible, but they had to have a way to transport those bodies. So in my story, I have an ox cart, and in fact, the ox cart breaks down at various points, and there's all sorts of travails about how to get their crew across England.
I'm trying to remember, was it a Steinbeck or a Hemingway book where they brought the grandmother across the country? Remember what I'm talking?
I think it was Grapes of Wrath, a Steinbeck book.
Okay, wow.
And then, of course, there's Faulkner with As They Lay Dying,
where
the grandmother is already dead.
That's the one I'm talking about. Yep.
Yeah, in fact, that was some inspiration to me, as well as Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
Yeah, that's a pretty macabre book with the grandmother. You know, you sort of have the visual of that going across the country.
Right.
You can join us at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. How do you write about the Middle Ages and know that you're being accurate?
Well, the short answer is we can't. A lot of what we have about more ancient eras is supposition or based on historical record, which is always fragmentary. So what I do as much as possible is read every piece of academic literature about the period, about the era, about the people. So one example is that I have a two-paragraph description of a village that they come into. And in order to write those two paragraphs, I read about 17 books, referenced several academic articles, tried to understand exactly what I was saying so that I could get those two paragraphs as accurate as possible. So throughout the book, there are all sorts of instances where I have a whole shelf of books that allowed me to write a sentence that I believe is accurate.
Wow.
One very, very short example is that I wrote a whole scene with the game of chess as an important piece. Turns out the game of chess wasn't invented at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to rewrite the scene to use an earlier game.
Wow, isn't that interesting? And you also, I read an interview that you gave in a newspaper, you said you didn't know that the ending surprised you. How's that possible?
Well, I found myself in my story overtaken by my main character. Mir became a really compelling figure, and she changed the story as I wrote it. So I thought I was going one direction, and her power as a person and her choices in the story made the story go in a very, very different direction, and I think a more powerful direction, something that was more authentic to her spirit.
How much did you have to go back and rewrite as a result of that?
Oh, I had to do brain surgery. I had to rip apart the whole plot and rewrite the beginning to accommodate the end. It's strange because Alice Walker actually says that she feels like she's writing down the stories of ghosts in her family's history. And I always thought that was balderdash.
Uh-huh.
And then I wrote this book, and I felt like Mir was an actual spirit speaking to me, saying, no, you got to get it right. This is my story. Tell it.
Okay. How did that manifest itself for you?
Well, it came out in the ending changing. It also came out in ways that she spoke out her truth to other characters that she met. I felt that she would be more in the background and would be observing more, kind of figuring out what was going on from behind the scenes. Turns out not so much. She definitely comes to the forefront. She decides moments where she's going to confront, and she became a really much more powerful figure than I had first envisioned.
Okay, but how did when you talk about Alice Walker and this talking about the ghosts and you feeling as though you were telling Mir's story, how did that, I mean, I know we're not talking automatic writing in the middle of the night here, right?
Right.
But did that manifest itself?
Well, I started writing one scene, for example, where they encounter a group of soldiers, and I thought, oh, they're just going to slip on past and make do, and the soldiers are going to beat them up a little bit. And then as I was writing that, I saw come out of my pen the fact that, you know, Mira was suddenly speaking. And I was like, wait a second, she hasn't spoken in 10 years? What the hell?
Mm-hmm.
And she started, you know, expressing herself and confronting these soldiers, and I just kept writing that scene, and it must have been in the back of my mind, or, you know, maybe Mira was a ghost, I don't know, but it wasn't automatic writing. Instead, it was a scene that seemed organic and natural, but I didn't know it existed before I wrote it.
Hmm. So did you really feel like you were writing it 100%, or was it just flowing out of somewhere out of you that really you didn't even have total control over?
Well, I think every novelist feels that a good scene or good writing comes out of an unexpressed place, comes out of the subconscious. So although I was writing it, it was definitely coming out of a place that I didn't know about before it came out of me.
Mm-hmm. You wrote this whole book while you were commuting on the train. Tell us about that.
I did. I wrote the first draft when I was on a commuter train every day going from Olympia, Washington, where I live, to Seattle, Washington, which is an hour by train. So I'd sit down with my notebook and I'd start writing for an hour, and then on the way home I'd write another hour. And Stephen King wrote a number of years ago, you know, if you write 300 words a day, which is about a page and a half, you'll have a book at the end of the year. And it was true. The first draft I completed within 6 months.
Uh-huh. Well, all right. And so you were able to concentrate when you were on a train and really get yourself into that 1377 kind of moment?
Yeah, it was fantastic to pull myself out of kind of the world of iPads and Facebook and focus in a different time period. I think it was a great release because when I stepped into a moment of starvation in winter and then I came back to, you know, stepping off into my Starbucks latte world, I felt really privileged.
Yeah, not with your grog and your bowl of gruel.
Exactly.
Yeah. Talk to me. You grew up, you were born in China. How long were you in China?
I grew up there until about fifth grade, until I was about 11 or 12.
Wow, what was that experience like?
It was really fascinating to grow up with another culture and another language. And I think it gave me a kind of outsider's perspective and allowed me to work with different languages now. I mean, for this novel, Sinful Folk, I worked in Greek and Latin and a little bit of Hebrew. That's kind of a spoiler for those who have read who have not read the book. But it gave me an ability to see through different eyes, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I'm able to look at things around me and look at stories and see a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Did you have difficulty making friends?
I'm actually still in touch with people I met there, including a friend named Wilson, who I met in fourth grade, who's now a PhD in biochemistry.
Wow. Okay. So did you go to Chinese schools? Was there an American school you went to? What kind of school did you go to?
I went to Chinese schools early on, and then I started going to American schools just before we left China.
Okay, so you left in fifth grade. What did your dad and mom do for a living?
Well, my parents were missionaries actually in China, so I have a deep and abiding family history in theology, and I got to discuss theology at depth with my parents as I was working on this book and working on a book set in a world where the church is predominant.
Right. Wow, isn't that interesting? So what are you trying to make any sort of a point about the Middle Ages in that era?
I'd like us to see the people there as fully fleshed human beings with real lives, with real concerns, with a connection to their families. And instead of just seeing them as, you know, a bunch of kings and queens with all of those peasants as refuse underneath them, I wanted us to see the peasants as fully embodied people.
Uh-huh. Speaking of theology, there was this story that came out that talked about archaeologists may have found the site of the trial of Jesus. How significant would that be, do you think?
Well, I don't really think that the site of the trial of Jesus is that astronomical as far as as far as a finding. If we found the cross itself, or if we found the ancient manuscripts other than the Bible that spoke about Jesus on earth and his ministry, I think it would change the equation. Because at this point in time, we don't have a lot of evidence outside of the biblical text about Jesus on earth. So if we could find documents from Roman antiquity that spoke about Jesus and spoke about who he was and what his ministry was like, that would add a huge amount of credibility to the ongoing narrative of the biblical text.
Mm-hmm. Back to the comparison between now and the Middle Ages. I mean, is there any comparison here beside, you know, we're eating better food? I mean, is there any comparison that's the same?
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of crossovers. One example that I found was that as I had early readers read this novel, every single woman said, "That's my experience." And I said, "What do you mean this is your experience?" And every single woman said, "I feel like I have to hide my gifts. I have to hide what I'm capable of in order to make it in a man's world." And it's interesting because we don't have, you know, women walking around with fake beards and mute voices, but in many ways we've silenced many voices that could contribute because we've created a world that privileges a white male voice all too often.
Mm-hmm. Boy, isn't that an interesting observation? You got that pretty consistently.
Yeah, I did. It was really fascinating. And we've also created a world where certain voices can be heard and are in the news all the time. And certain voices are pushed down. I mean, we can even see this in the whole Ferguson thing, where the message coming out of that situation is, you're not listening to us.
Mm-hmm. Also, I would say the disparity between the gap between rich and poor is pretty high point at this point in our history, and probably was back then too.
Exactly. In fact, if you compare what the kings made in comparison to the billionaire CEOs today, it's pretty much the same across the board. We aren't as poor physically as peasants were, but as far as the gap between rich and poor, that's almost identical.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a sequel to Sinful Folk called Garden of Earthly Delights, and I kind of changed things around because this time around, Mir is a noblewoman, so she's on the other side of the equation, and she has to now grapple with that idea of privilege and who is she now in this world. So the world back then had this concept of the Wheel of Fortune, that you could go from being very poor up to the very highest echelon, and I make that happen in this sequel. It's been very interesting to have her have a different perspective now that she's on the privileged side of the fence.
Mm-hmm. The reaction that you got from women who read the book, how did they feel that you had done in terms of capturing the spirit and the voice of a woman character?
Well, I really need to give my wife a lot of credit for her influence on the book, because she's a childbirth educator. She's been a mom for many years, and she was able to refine and help me get the voice right. Without her input, I think I would have gotten a lot of things wrong. So.
So you were able, by the time those readers read it, you pretty well had your wife improve it, sounds like.
Well, I think so. I think having a lot of people read your work before it's fully in the market is very, very helpful. I refined it all the way along. I had about 27 different people who were able to read various drafts, including the New York agent, Jenny Bent, who gave me a lot of really useful input.
Uh-huh. You also worked with a pretty powerful illustrator on this, too. Who is that?
Her name is Nikki McClure, and she's a well-known New York Times bestselling illustrator and author. She did a hand-cut, paper-cut cover, and then she did 8 different internal illustrations to illustrate different portions of the book. And she read the book, and she had input on how the character would react to things. A very, very short story here. I also sent the book to Karen Maitland, who is a best-selling international author based in England. And she came back with a glowing endorsement. And then she also sent me a list of small details that I'd missed in the Middle Ages. For example, she pointed out that beer at that time was brewed with barley, not with hops. And so I needed to make sure to point that out in the text. Small details that were really important to make sure I was getting it right.
Mm, that was that beer they were drinking while they were playing chess, right?
Exactly. I love exactly.
That. So what was the board game of choice back then at that time?
Well, it was a precursor to chess that was invented by people who were crusaders in Israel and in Palestine, and it involved a bunch of stones that had different shapes and different colors, and so it was a predecessor to chess, but it wasn't called chess, and the rules were somewhat different. In fact, you rolled dice to figure out your moves.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. That sounds like kind of an interesting game.
Yeah. I'd like to play it.
Hey, thank you for your time this morning, and good luck in your efforts.
Oh, thanks so much. Take care, Mark.
Ned Hayes is the author of Sinful Folk. It's a historical novel that centers around the time of the Middle Ages, 1377, and a fire that killed five children. Our numbers on the program are 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. Coming up in about 45 minutes after our White House report, we'll chat with political analyst Eric Davis. We'll chat about not only the Vermont legislature, but we'll also talk about some national issues as well, too. Congress going back into session tomorrow. New Republican majority in the Senate. A lot of discussion already about what their agenda will be. Oh, my goodness. Looks like 2 years of it could be a very, very contentious couple of years. So we'll get Professor Davis's thoughts on that as well. We'll also talk with our White House crew. Victoria Jones joins us on Mondays. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Quick break. Back after this.
Are you looking for something fun to do? This week's World Newspaper has a large community calendar covering all of the central Vermont towns. Events include free workshops, play groups, support groups, yoga, and even clogging and Irish step lessons. The World will also have the latest Senate report from Senator Doyle as he delves into a recent report exploring the impact of international students on higher education in the U.S. Plus, the Barrie Area Senior Center will be celebrating its greatest achievement of 2014, and the World will be there to cover the Senior Center's ribbon cutting on Friday at its new location. You don't want to miss a week of your World. You can pick up your free copy at over 250 newsstands throughout central Vermont. Get your World at places like Price Chopper, Shaw's, and Hannaford. The World, central Vermont's hometown newspaper for over 40 years.
Hi, this is Kim St. John from Waterbury Pharmacy. More than half of the accidental poisonings occur in children under the age of 6. Here's a few things you can do to avoid this. Keep all medicines in their original bottle and out of reach. Try to avoid taking medicines in front of children because they like to copy adults. Never call medicine candy. Never leave children alone with your medicine, even to answer the phone. Always have adequate lighting, so you make sure to give the correct medicine and dosage. If a poisoning occurs, try to stay calm. If the victim has passed out or is not breathing, call 911. If the victim is awake, call the Poison Control Center at 1-800-222-1222. Make sure to have the age, weight, and what the victim took and how much was taken if possible. If you have more questions about your medicine, call us at 244-7701. Waterbury Pharmacy, locally owned and proud to be independent.
.244-1777 is our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. A moment of your time for our friend Mike Russell at the Tailor Shop in Stowe's Lower Village, who took a little time off, but now back in business. He'll be back there on Wednesday. The tailor shop is open on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. If you need to get items tailored inward or outward, maybe got something really nice for Christmas this year and it doesn't just quite fit right, before you send it back and into that whole whirlwind, maybe you want to just bring it on up to Mike at the tailor shop on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and he can really make it all happen for you. He does some excellent work. He will find material and clothing that you just didn't really even know was there, and quick turnaround time, too. So make sure you always leave him plenty of time if you got an event that you have a special item that you want to wear. Maybe that tuxedo doesn't fit exactly the right way either. So you can stop it up and see Mike. The tailor shop is on the right-hand side of Route 100 as you head up here from the Waterbury area. And it is just past the sign for Stowe's Lower Village. You'll see the Shell station on your right. And then that next driveway after that, that's where Mike's shop is set up. So stop it in and see him. He opens the doors at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Our numbers on the program are 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. A couple of notable deaths to begin the year. Former New York Governor Mario Cuomo dying on New Year's Day at the age of 82. And then this morning, actually late last night, I caught the story. I was really sad to see this. 49 years old, Stuart Scott, who is one of the originals at ESPN, which, you know, the great sports network. I just saw this history recently of ESPN. In fact, it was down. We took a nice little adventure down to Washington, D.C., one of the really cool museums down there is something called the Newseum. It's N-E-W-S-E-U-M, kind of a combination of museum and news. As you might imagine, it was a place kind of fun for somebody like me to hang out. And they had, you could spend, it's one of these museums like the Shelburne Museum, and God bless both of them for doing this. When you buy a ticket at both of those places, it's good for the next day, too. And there are a lot of museums. The cool thing about Washington, a lot of places are free. But in this case, it was great to be able to know that you could go back the next day. But they had footage of the early day. Lee Leonard, one of the early hosts on ESPN. My goodness, the first original early sets of ESPN look like something out of what our friend Ned Hayes might be writing about. I mean, it was like the desk that you had in third or fourth grade, with Lee Leonard sitting behind it with a logo that was kind of barely even spelled correctly, and it was tiny too. And it, boy, you look at what this operation is today, and it is just a behemoth. But one of the early signature announcers on ESPN is Stuart Scott, who really made famous a couple of great phrases, but was a real pioneer to African American journalists on TV. He passed away at the age of 49, which, you know, any of you out there, when you start to get to be about that age and you read about people that are dying that are younger than you, is always a little. Always a little chilling. I wanted to share with you, I found there was a speech that he gave recently, about 6 months ago, where he received a very prestigious award named after Jimmy Valvano, who was the great basketball coach who also died at a very early age of cancer. And so Stuart Scott gave this talk at this event. He was introduced by Kiefer Sutherland, and Stuart Scott mentions on this that he is a big fan of that show. So I want to share with you an excerpt of his the award that he got, the Jimmy V. Perseverance Award, and then perhaps maybe we can talk about some of the points that he made in this speech.
24 is my favorite TV show of all time, so Kiefer Sutherland, thank you very much. I am very honored. Every day I am reminded that our life's journey is really about the people who touch us. When I first heard that I was going to be honored with this reward, the very first thing that I did was I was speechless, briefly. I've presented this award before. I mean, I've watched in awe as Kay Yao and Eric LeGrand and all these other great people grace this stage. And although intellectually I get it, I'm a public figure, I have a public job, I'm battling cancer, hopefully I'm inspiring, at my gut level, I really didn't think that I belonged with those great people. But I listened to what Jim Valvano said 21 years ago. The most poignant 7 words ever uttered in any speech anywhere. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. Those great people didn't. Coach Valvano didn't. So to be honored with this, I now have a responsibility to also not ever give up. I'm not special. I just listened to what the man said. I listened to all that he said, everything that he asked of us, and that's to build the V Foundation. And let me tell you, man, it works. I'm talking tangible benefits. You saw me in that clinical trial. Now, here's the thing about that. Coach Valvano's words 21 years ago, helping me and thousands of people like me right now, direct benefits. That's why all of this, why we're here tonight, that's why it's so important. I also realized something else recently. You heard me kind of allude to it in the piece. I said, I'm not losing. I'm still here. I'm fighting. I'm not losing. But I got to amend that. When you die, that does not mean that you lose to cancer. You beat cancer by how you live, why you live, and in the manner in which you live. So live, live, fight like hell. And when you get too tired to fight, then lay down and rest and let somebody else fight for you. That's also very, very important. I can't do this don't give up thing all by myself. I got thousands of people on Twitter and on the streets who encourage me. I got these amazingly wonderful people at ESPN. I got corporate executives, my bosses, this is true, who will text message me. And I'll say, hey, heard you had chemotherapy today. You want me to stop by on the way home from work and pick you up something to eat and bring it to you? Seriously? Who does that? Whose boss does that? My bosses do that. But even with all that, the fight is still much more difficult than I even realized. What you didn't see in the piece is what's gone on probably the last 10 days. I just got out of the hospital this past Friday. 7-day stay. Man, I crashed. I had liver complications. I had kidney failure. I had 4 surgeries in a span of 7 days. I had tubes and wires running in and out of every part of my body. And guys, when I say every part of my body, every part of my body. As of Sunday, I didn't even know if I'd make it here. I couldn't fight. But doctors and nurses could. The people that I love, my friends and family, they could fight. My girlfriend, who slept on a very uncomfortable hospital cot by my side every night, she could fight. The people that I love did last week what they always do. They visited, they talked to me, they listened to me, they sat silent sometimes. They loved me. And that's another one of the components of the V Foundation. This whole fight, this journey thing is not a solo venture. This is something that requires support. I called my big sister Susan a few days ago. Why? I needed to cry. It was that simple. And I know that I can call her. I can call my other sister Cynthia, my brother Stephen, my mom and dad, and I can just cry. And those things are very important. I have one more necessity. Yeah, it's really two. Two very vibrant, intelligent, beautiful young ladies. The best thing I have ever done, the best thing I will ever do,
is be a dad to Taylor and Sydney. It's true. I can't ever give up because I can't leave my daughters. Yes, sometimes I embarrass them. Sometimes they think I'm a tyrant. That's a direct quote. There is an adjective that describes tyrant too, but I'm not going to go there. But Taylor and Sydney, I love you guys more than I will ever be able to express. You two are my heartbeat. I am standing on this stage here tonight because of you. My oldest daughter, Taylor, I wanted her to be here, but college sophomore, summer school, second semester, starting this week. Baby girl, I love you, but you go do you. You go do that. My littlest angel is here. My 14-year-old. Sydney, come up here and give Dad a hug because I need one. I want to say thank you, ESPN. Thank you, ESPYs. Thank all of you. Have a great rest of your night and have a great rest of your life.
He's sportscaster Stuart Scott, who gave a, this was back in July of last year, so some 6 months ago. And as one of his signature lines, yep, just about as cool as the other side of the pillow. Pretty cool guy. But here's what, I have a question for you on this. This whole question that he raised, this question about the seven words that he quoted of Jimmy Valvano, don't give up, don't ever give up. You know, I was actually glad at one point there that he mentioned that, you know, you can fight and you can fight and you can fight. And then, you know, there is actually a time, I think, to lay down your arms when it comes to stuff like this. And, you know, then I thought that was an interesting and very poignant suggestion he made there, that others can then pick up the mantle for you. I'd love to know what your reaction was to that. I found that to be fairly profound. 244-1777 is our local number, toll free 877-291-8255. We're going to talk politics coming up next hour. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin the hour, then we'll be joined by political analyst Eric Davis. We'll talk about some of what he anticipates will happen later this week at the Vermont Legislature. Also, we'll talk about some national politics as well, too. You're welcome to join us throughout. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Looking for a great place to go for lunch today? Why not on a dark and increasingly cold day like today? You could scoot on down and see our friends at Red Hen Cafe and Bakery right off of Interstate 89, Exit 9, right there in Middlesex. Always have two piping hot soups available. Suits is actually, I guess, Mike's job up at the tailor shop. They handle the soups down at Red Hen Cafe and Bakery. And by the way, you know, if you wear like your best clothing down there and like, you know, you burn a little hole in your beautiful suit as a result of that hot soup, it really won't happen, but you could bring that on up to Mike. One note for you, Red Hen does close a tad earlier than usual on Mondays. They close at 4 on Mondays, and the rest of the week they close at 6, so you can stop there on the way home, pick up a few items for dinner, and you can always stop there first thing in the morning. They open the doors at 7 a.m. for some of the best Danish that you will ever have in your life, some of those signature sticky buns. You bring a few of those to the office, you'll make a few friends to start the year here. And as you heard, you know, Stuart Scott say, you may need those friends someday. So that may be a very small investment you make there with that sticky bun. Red Hen Cafe and Bakery right off of Interstate 89, Exit 9 in Middlesex. And feel free to get a couple of those sticky buns for yourself, too. Quick break. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
I love Hunger Mountain Co-op not only for Mom's Best Toasted Wheatfuls, but especially for its shopping experience mojo with focused and friendly staff. I'm Al Kyman from Middlesex, and I've been a member here at the co-op for 20 years.
Yo, didn't I bring you good news from the Aqua Lair at One Stop Country Pet Supply? Me, Lenny, and Oscar have been waiting for yous to show up so we could talk about the fantastic aquatics that'll be happening here at the store all month long.
Can I tell them, Tank? Can I please?
Don't get your fins all in a twist there, Lenny.
Yeah, Lenny, what Tank said.
All month long, we'll be having sales on a variety of aquarium-related items. Each week, there will be a new sale. And we're starting with filters. Purchase a select Aquion Quiet Flow filter between January 2nd and 8th. Get a 20 or 29 gallon Aquion fish tank absolutely free.
Can I tell them they can save on gravel and decorations too?
New aquatic items go on sale every Friday through the month of January, so don't swim too far away.
Come see us during January for super savings on all things aquatic. This week, buy a filter, get a tank free. One Stop Country Pet Supply, Brattleboro and Barry, Vermont, and in the center at Colony Mill, Key, New Hampshire. Open every day.
Do you have water damage or soot damage? Call SR Services in Montpelier. They're the experts. Don't get discouraged if your home has been damaged by water from flooding or a leaky roof. SR Services has the equipment and expertise to restore the appearance of your home to like new again. They work on tile and grout floors, too. Gray grout lines will be white again, thanks to SR Services. For water and smoke damage or professional carpet cleaning, call SR Services at 223-6577. SR Services, 407 Barry Street in Montpelier, 223-6577.
Is our local number in Central Vermont. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. We were earlier this hour, we were talking with Ned Hayes, who had written this book about the medieval era, and I was asking him about income inequality, and we were comparing, we were trying to figure out if there were any comparisons between back then and today. Love to hear from you at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. And I was mentioning that there was an interesting graph that was printed at the end of last year, seems like just days ago, that talked about the share of wealth in the United States from 1913 to 2012, so, 100-year period here. And it is, I'll do my best here because, it is radio. Graphs are always fun on the radio, but I think you'll get the drift here pretty easily, which is that really we are at a period of time in here where the amount of wealth that is concentrated in a small number of households is close to a record level. The only time that it was even higher than this was back in the late 1920s and also in the roaring teens as well, too, when it was at 25%. So let me give you some numbers here. And here, this was done by a group of economists, Emmanuel Saez at the University of California, Berkeley, and Gabriel Zuckman of the London School of Economics. And here is what they found. In 2012, which was the most recent numbers that were available, they found that the top 0.1% of households, that's the top 0.1%, that's even smaller than 1%, my friends, that this 0.1% of households lay claim to 22% of U.S. wealth. I mean, that's breathtaking, isn't it? If by way of comparison, the where this sort of bottomed out, I guess, or maybe you could say was the most equal, was in 1979, when that same group of people, this 0.1% of households, not 22% like today, but 7%. I mean, that is a dramatic reduction. So what you basically have when you look at this graph, when you've got the early eras here of 1913, 1923, where things really were at their peak, were even higher than they are today, then from 1928 down to that 1979 figure, it slopes down in a very nice little gradual decline till you get down to this 7% number. And then really starting in 1979, with few exceptions, it really steadily rises right back up, creating almost a the picture of a swing or something. I mean, it's or a nice, big, evenly shaped kind of U that goes. And, you know, maybe you don't think that this is a major problem facing our country. But, you know, each time that this has happened in the past, we have run into these eras of great inequality, which then has great disruption. I mean, one of the, you know, the stock market crash, you can't help but notice, was at this last peak period here. So, you know, you do have to wonder, what, if anything, anybody can do about this? What, if anything, anybody wants to do about this, considering that many of our political leaders are really representing this group of people, in part because of the way that we have set up the system so that their, you know, political campaigns get financed by some of these folks. I think we all know that it doesn't take a rocket scientist, and it's naive to think otherwise, that people with this kind of wealth can have great influence on the political system. And I still just, it staggers me that this last piece of legislation that Congress passed right before they left was a continuing resolution to allow the government to stay open another $1 trillion. And, you know, part of this included two just dreadful provisions in it. One, which allows individuals to, and by significant numbers, increase the amount of money that they're allowed to give to political parties, which are supposed to then independently coordinate from candidates what they spend the money on. We all know that's not true. We all know that doesn't happen. We all know that in many cases they really don't even need to speak to one another. You know, these advocacy groups know exactly what points to make without somebody suggesting what they are. I mean, that seems pretty obvious. So we have a political system which is geared towards that. The other provision, which was just awful, was this undermining of the legislation that was passed after the 2008 financial crisis, which will, in essence, allow banks to get back into the exact same speculative business that got many of them in trouble in the first place. So, you know, and why would that kind of legislation get rewritten? You know, I haven't heard any of you calling this program or screaming out nationally any sort of big movement that, you know, banks really are suffering or that we're suffering, and that somehow banks have to get back into this speculative business. You know, this is clearly something that was driven by the banking interests, waiting for that moment when they knew that legislation needed to be passed, and they hopped right in on the back end of it. So, you know, we have two things here. So we, you know, we can't just say that this is a problem in the past, that this is a problem, oh, back in the 80s and the 90s or whatever. It is continuing today. When you have those kind of practices, it's just it's dreadful. And yes, they were reported on, but they, you know, most people are just going to go about their business, do their job, and this kind of stuff, you know, somehow gets through. It's amazing. Fred, Happy New Year to you. How you doing? All right.
Very well, thank you, Mark. Happy New Year to you and your family.
Thanks.
Two things here. Let them eat cake. Remember that from the French Revolution. You know, pretty soon the haves and the have-nots, the have-nots are going to be so pissed off that they're going to take it from the haves. And it's not going to be pretty. I'm not going to say it's going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen sometime, Mark, and it's not going to be pretty when it happens here in America.
So how do you think that's going to manifest itself, Fred?
I don't know, Mark. It's going to... I still can't believe that the Citizens United, to me, was where the country really made a bad turn here. And from it's, you know, Elizabeth Warren this week, just to dovetail into the other thing, she was the one that stood up and said, no, let's not give these bankers what they almost bankrupted us about.
Right. And she's also preventing this guy from getting on a board who has no business getting on this board.
Well, it's all about, I can't think of the name of the street where all the lobbyists reside on down there in Washington. I think K Street or something.
K Street.
And they own us, Mark. Between the K Street guys and Israel, I think they own us. I really do.
Well,
I really do.
You're talking about lobbyists, I think, in both cases there. Thank you, Fred. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. We're going to take a break here for news, and then we'll hear from our White House crew to begin hour number two. We're also going to, next hour, we'll check in with political analyst Eric Davis. Love to have you join us on the program as well, too. 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Keep your dial right here. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush, FM 96.5 in Barrie and Montpelier, and the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is next.